This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Emma Rice, a winemaker at Hattingley, but also you set up and run Custom Crush, which is a wine lab based in Hampshire in England. How are you, Emma?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Last week we talked a wee bit about the sort of when you might do testing and some of the issues associated with it. This week I want to actually talk about the specific tests that different wines undergo. And last week we talked about when you would do it, and you mentioned things like, oh, well, you do it just before harvest, you might do it just before fermentation or after fermentation and before bottling and etc. So let's start with the sort of tests you might do just before harvest, because that's start the process. Some of these tests I always think the viticulturists can do, because people often talk about measuring sugar levels, and you get these little refractometers that you can put your drop of juice in and look at what's going on, but you offer Brix measurements. So what's the advantage of sending your juice off to be measured with you guys, rather than using one of those what are they? I've forgotten the name of them.
A refractometer.
It is a refractometer. Yeah, yeah. How do they work, and how does that differ to what you do?
Well, they essentially measure the total soluble solids in the juice by using, they refract the light to measure it on a certain absorbance level. So we use a digital refractometer, which is it's handheld. You could take it out to the vineyard. But the thing I get annoyed with vineyard managers, and they all do it, is they walk around the vineyard, they pick one berry that looks really ripe, and they squeeze it onto their refractometer and go, oh, look, it's 19 Brix. And I'm like, yeah, but have you seen the color of the other berries on that bunch? That bunch is not going to be 19 Brix. It's just that berry. So when we're taking samples, juice samples into the laboratory, we generally ask for grape samples. And I insist on at least 10 bunches from across the vineyard site, each parcel. And they must be selected blind. So, you know, pick your vine in advance of going out to the vineyard, stick your hand into the vine and take the first bunch that you come across without looking. Because the human eye is always drawn to the best looking bunch, and you can't help it. And I'm guilty of doing that as well. So if you're going around the vineyard with a handheld refractometer looking at individual berries, it's absolutely pointless. I mean, it might give you a sense of well-being that your grapes are nice and they're ripening, but it's not going to give you an accurate reflection of what the vineyard is doing at the time. Sugar is only one measurement, and you can do that in the vineyard, yes, with the refractometer very easily. But sugar and acidity and pH do not necessarily correlate. And so we know we can add sugar to the wine chaptalized. That's something that's accepted practice. It's done all over Champagne. It's done all over England, all over Northern Europe. We know we can add sugar if we need to tweak that up a little bit. But what is harder to manage is the acidity. Mm. So we're often picking on acidity, not sugar. And I need to know what the total acidity is, but also something that is very difficult unless you've got a specialist piece of kit, is pH as well.
Can't you just dip it in with those litmus papers things?
They're not accurate enough. Oh,
okay.
No. So I need to know when I'm buying grapes, or if I'm sourcing grapes, or I'm advising someone on the ripeness of their crop, I need to know what the acidity is and the pH as well. So sugar by itself is it's a rough guide, but it's essentially a bit worthless. Also, unless I've seen the bunches and know how they've sampled them from the vineyard, then it's only as good as the results they get are only as good as the sample they send. Mm. So if they've not sampled representatively, then it's not going to be reflective of the actual ripeness in the vineyard.
What's the difference between acidity, total acidity, and pH? I sort of think I know, but I'd like you to clarify it.
Okay, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but pH is a measurement. Total acidity is a measurement of all of the disassociated hydrogen ions in the juice, whereas the pH is a measurement of all of it. So they don't necessarily correlate. As your ripeness TA drops, the pH doesn't necessarily drop. because here in England particularly, we find that we, as this acidity, let's say we're picking Pinot Noir at 12 grams per litre total acidity expressed as tartaric, 8 of that could be malic acid and 3-4 of it be tartaric and other acids. If I were in California, it would be very different. The tartaric would be the predominant acid and the malic would have degraded a lot faster.
Malic's very common in cooler climates, isn't it? You don't see it in warmer climates.
Yeah. So pH can... this is a very good example. We had one vineyard in Essex picked his Pinot Noir in two tranches. The first lot came in, he picked all the right looking bunches and he left the slightly greener, pinker ones behind on my instruction. And the first lot came in at 12 grams per litre total acidity, a pH of 3.05, and a Brix measurement of, let's say, 17 Brix, which is fine, good analysis for sparkling base wine. And then he went back 2 weeks later to pick what the Pinot Noir that was left that had since ripened up, or visually ripened up. And this is my bad, because I took his sugar measurement and acidity measurement that he'd done in a field, and it showed that it had ripened to a similar level of 12 grams per litre of acidity and about 16.5 Brix. So I was like, great, bring it in. It arrived, we pressed it, put it into tank, and the pH came out 2.8. As it got colder and colder and wetter through the harvest, the pH just hadn't changed much, or hadn't really properly ripened. So luckily it was a very small overall volume and not the end of the world. But and one thing I noticed in 2020 and 2018, the two sort of miracle vintages, 2018 was a miracle vintage in terms of yield and ripeness. 2020 was small yield, but super ripe. Was that the sugars were riper, the acid was lower, but the pH didn't really change much. So we're generally getting in the grapes coming in at pHs of 2.85 to 3.1 mm-hmm. at the highest, and that range didn't change, even in those years when it was super ripe in terms of sugar and acidity. And the pH has such a huge effect on the viability of the yeast, the viability of malolactic bacteria, the effectiveness of the SO2 additions or not, that kind of thing. So the pH is absolutely vital. And unless you've got a really good pH meter, which is well calibrated and well maintained, you can't rely on it.
Okay.
Very long-winded answer, sorry.
No, it's an excellent answer. I like it a lot. I like it a lot. I thought what you were saying about the importance of pH, because the acidity in the wine is really important for all sorts of things, whether it be aging, the way the tannins polymerize as the wine ages. You talked about fermentation as well. The lower the acidity, the harder it is for fermentation. And even the amount of SO2 that you need to add to your wine varies as well because of the pH level. So it is a very important measurement. Another important measurement that you might do before harvest is YAN. YAN. If I said it right, YAN. YAN.
Yep. YAN. So the yeast assimilable nitrogen.
Yeah, so this is quite a catchy topic, isn't it?
So we do that for certain vineyards who request it. We have found historically over the years that the classic varieties of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, generally, obviously there will be exceptions, generally those classic varieties grown in England don't have a problem with yeast available nitrogen. It's usually in well over 200 milligrams per litre, pushing 300 milligrams per litre, which is well within the realms of viability for the yeast to access. The varieties that I have come across in England that can suffer from very low YAN, things like Bacchus and Sauvignon Blanc, possibly, grown on certain soil types particularly, they can be very low. And then you would want to know, so you could add some ammonia nitrogen to the yeast as you're going through fermentation.
And the importance of nitrogen or available nitrogen to the yeast is it's like a major part of their food source, isn't it?
It is. So if they don't have enough nitrogen to consume, they will start to die off and struggle to continue and finish the fermentation. And that's when you get reductive aromas of hydrogen sulfides, and you also get stuck fermentation. So not only do they get a bit stinky, they can also stop or get stuck. So the idea is that you want to keep your yeast happy and feed them at certain times, if necessary, to make sure that they don't run out of steam in order to finish the fermentation.
Years ago, probably about 15 years ago, I interviewed a lady called Siobhan Hannett from Cloudy Bay. She was a head viticulturist at Cloudy Bay. And she was going on about yen being really, really super important. But you don't want to have to fix it in the winery. You want to get it right in the vineyard by doing various things in the vineyard. Because she described that giving it nitrogen in the winery is feeding it a load of burgers and chips. You know, the yeast will eat it and do it, but it's not the best sort of type, I suppose. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, it's like eating ultra-processed food, I suppose, rather than getting it from the fruit and veggies. So I guess, yes. And if we're lucky in England, for the varieties that we're mainly working with here, is we don't generally have a problem with it. And the other thing you can do is there are non- or sort of organic compounds, deactivated yeast hulls, for example, which you can also use. And that can help with the yeast to feed them and keep them happy. And they may have a little bit of DAP or diammonium phosphate nitrogen in there to feed the yeast. But there are various ways and means. But yes, you're right. You don't want to have to add anything if you don't have to. We're not natural winemakers here at Hattingley, but we certainly don't add things for the sake of it. We only add if we have to.
So, for example, Siobhan was talking about doing things in the winery. I can't remember exactly what she was saying. It was quite a few years ago. But if you're doing pre-fermentation yen testing, it's a little bit late to make adjustments in the vineyard to do anything.
Yeah, way too late. Yeah. You can do it for next year, though, so there's no harm in checking, even because then you know whether you need to make an adjustment in the winery, and then you can talk to your vineyard manager and say, right, okay, next growing season, what can we do to try and improve that nitrogen level naturally, rather than having to, you know, wang a load of DAP in now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And the last test I think you guys do before fermentation is malo testing, which in the UK, as we said earlier, is really, really super important because cooler climates tend to have a lot of malo acid, and malo acid tends to be quite a sharp green acid type of taste. Is there anything, knowing your malo, and I imagine most English wineries go through a malolactic conversion later on after alcoholic fermentation anyway, what information, knowing your malo before fermentation, what helps you there? What's the advantage of that?
We have a very, very complicated malolactic fermentation plan here at Hattingley, and there's no hard and fast rule, so not every tank will go through, and some years a higher percentage will go through. So give you an example, this year there of the four 350 tons of fruit that came in, only two loads of Chardonnay, so about 10 tons in total, did not end up being put through malolactic fermentation, whereas a lot of the Pinot Noir and a lot of the Pinot Meunier has not gone through malolactic fermentation.
Oh.
So we want to know what the malic acid level is on the grape, on the juice to start with, because we do co-inoculation. So we culture up bacteria right from the first day of harvest, and then we feed it into the selected tanks about 2 or 3 days after alcoholic fermentation has started. So we're using the heat from the alcoholic fermentation to help get the malolactic fermentation going and to run it and to help feed the bacteria as well. And that works very well for us, but we don't put everything through. And so going back to this, you know, let's say you've got 12 grams of total acidity in your wine expressed as tartaric, but anything between 5 and 8 of that could be malic acid. So I need to make sure that what I don't do is put everything through malolactic fermentation and then lose most of that acidity. And then the acidity drops through the floor because the malic acid is all gone. And then I end up with flabby wines, which no one would imagine that you'd get in England, but it can happen.
Yeah.
Also, I might actually decide a wine that's got really high malic acid, I'm not going to even attempt to put that through because I know I can blend it with something later. This is all having to be sort of thinking on your feet as you're going, knowing what's going to happen to that particular block. Because if you're asking the malolactic bacteria to consume all of that malic acid, they might struggle and they might start to give off flavors that you don't want. I always use the analogy of, it's like going into an all-you-can-eat buffet and the huge table of food laid out in front of you. It's all you can eat, but you've got to eat all of it. And there's no way that most people could. You might have a give it a go, but then you might start to feel a bit ill. You might get wind. And that's what happens to the bacteria. If you ask them to do too much, then sometimes they can just give up the ghost and go, you know what, I can't do this anymore. So I haven't got enough energy left to consume all of this malic acid. We had one tank this year which struggled to finish towards the end, and it did start to produce some slightly off aromas. But again, luckily it's a part of a much bigger, we'll go into a much bigger blend, so it's not the end of the world. And it was only a very small volume. So we are very careful not to put everything in the winery through malolactic fermentation. Otherwise, everything starts to taste a bit the same, as far as I'm concerned.
When I'm teaching students about malolactic, we say, oh, it'll taste like butter or yogurt or those buttery flavors. But most red wines undergo some sort of malolactic and they never taste of butteriness. And for ages, I used to pull my hair out trying to understand it. And then I realized, and I'd love someone to confirm this, that just like yeast, there's different flavors of malolactic bacteria, and some of them are more likely to give off the buttery aromas and some of them are less likely. Is it a function of the grape variety or the strain of malolactic that will give off the butteriness, or is it a mixture of both?
I think it's probably a mixture of both. We tend to use the same bacteria, which is a strain that was identified in Champagne that's able to cope with the very low pHs that we're working at. Or more able to cope. It's diacetyl, which is that buttery character or popcorn flavor. Yeah. That's what we do not want that in our base wines.
No.
We don't put anything in oak. Anything that's fermented in oak will not go through malolactic fermentation, because we find it's too difficult to control the temperature in the barrels. And so they end up struggling. When the bacteria are struggling, they can give off these off flavors of really popcorn, buttered popcorn, which might be nice in a Californian Chardonnay, but it's certainly not what you want in an English sparkling wine. So those flavors are often more to do with, I think, to do more with a struggling bacteria or a struggling malolactic fermentation, or something that's gone very slow because the temperature's been low, pH is low, and it's taken too long. And you can get some slightly volatile aromas coming as well.
So would you say those buttery aromas can be almost a fault in some wine? Well, certainly in your wines, but in other wines as well?
It could be described as a fault, yes. But it's like Brettanomyces is a fault. It's actually also part of the terroir of certain wines from the Rhone Valley. So it's all subjective and open to interpretation and what you expect. So a flavour that's great in a Californian oak Chardonnay is not something that we would describe that as a fault in one of our wines or bad winemaking.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I think what we'll do, Emma, is we'll leave it there. Cheers very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.